We're going to have two sessions tonight on healthcare. This first one, I'm going to talk about a few issues that I'm close to as a result of some studies that I'm doing. And the second session will be after Vespers, and will be a forum on, I think it's entitled, Can We Afford to Get Sick? Which is an appropriate question. Being sick right now, I'm in good shape to address that. It's a case of the Holden crud here, so hopefully you'll be able to hear me okay. I believe most Holden sessions, this is my first one I've ever done. My name is Jim Goes. I'm on the operational staff here. In fact, I've been responsible for all that noise you've been hearing, perhaps you've been hearing it about 6 o'clock in the morning the last few days. Yeah.
Did you fell trees? I thought they were felling trees.
We didn't fell any. We were just cutting them up into firewood. Village consumes an incredible amount of firewood in the winter, and so it's a big job. But anyway, this is my vacation in the real world. As we say, I'm studying for a PhD in the business school at the University of Oregon. And the particular interest of mine is hospitals. And that's what got me into this area of healthcare. And I've just become very fascinated with some of the issues that are going on in it. And I'll share a little bit of what I'm thinking and what we're seeing with you tonight. Okay? This is kind of an open style. Feel free to ask questions or jump in with any comments at any time. I think we'll have lots of time to talk about these issues because we'll have a forum this evening. And we'll also have time in the next hour or until the Vespers bell rings. Well, they're still filing in. I can't believe it. I didn't think anybody would be here.
Lutherans don't like to sit in front row, but
yeah. Okay. Well, let me tell you first of all why I use that term revolution, because it actually shows up in, I'm finishing my dissertation, and it shows up in the title of my dissertation as well. And I think it's an accurately chosen word, because there is truly a revolution going on in the way healthcare is delivered in this country. And it's very interesting to me from an organizational perspective. Probably more interesting to you as a function of how you get care delivered to you personally and how much it costs you. Okay, Webster defines a revolution as a radical or pervasive change, a sudden and complete shift in the way things are going. It's hard to identify one event that has changed healthcare dramatically. It's easier to identify a string of events over time, in particular over the last 10 or 15 years. That have had a very profound impact on the way healthcare services are delivered. Okay, so my goals are pretty humble for this session. Is to just first of all try to identify some of the causes of this revolution that's going on, discuss some of the more obvious effects, and hopefully you'll be able to chime in. I very much hope you will with how this has affected you. And then try to identify some of the implications of these. And some of these implications are rather subtle, and you don't see them in your patient-doctor relationship. But the way in which healthcare is being delivered is changing dramatically. And beyond this, these goals, I'll just kind of leave this open to you and identify where you'd like to go with it. And I hope that will feed into some discussion that will feed into the forum this evening, and that you'll have lots to talk about in that regard. Well, how important is this issue? I would take this as at least partial evidence that it's very important to you. it's important to me because I got to graduate and get a job. But healthcare expenditures, I think in 1986, accounted for about 20% of the gross national product. That's a lot, considering that defense expenditures of the GNP, I think, are only 30 to 40% or something like that. So it's a very important, become a very important component of our of our gross national product and an expense. In studying it, our approach has almost been necessarily historical to look at how things have changed over time. And even though I'm a student of management, I've become a bit of a closet historian by looking at how hospitals, in particular, and healthcare in general, has changed over a period of time. And actually, it's the relevant period of time is almost 100 years, but the big changes have happened in the last 10 or 15 years, and those are the ones I'll focus on primarily. I'm a student of organizations. I'm particularly interested in how organizations adapt to changes in their own environments and in the world around them and in their constituents and a number of other things. Particularly major change in industries that go through big shifts. Hospitals and healthcare were not traditionally an industry until the last 5 to 10 years, when the profit motive came into play in healthcare delivery. And so they've become relevant for me, where maybe 10 or 15 years ago, as a student of business, I wouldn't even really be looking at hospitals too much. But that's...
How has the profit motive changed?
Well, can you hang on to it for a second? I think it's a good question, and I think I'll kind of meander into it in a few minutes, okay? In particular, I'm studying hospitals in the San Francisco Bay Area. There are two markets that are identified as kind of the bellwethers, the leaders in healthcare delivery. One is one with which most of you are probably familiar, the Twin Cities. Is anybody here from Minnesota? Yeah. That's a loaded question at home, okay? But because you know you're going to get some hands. That's one market, and California is the second. They're both regarded as kind of the leaders in delivering healthcare and in innovative ways of providing healthcare services and new technologies and a variety of other things. So it's a good place to study it, and I've been studying it over the past year and a half. It's taken a lot longer than I planned. It's taken me longer to graduate than I planned, but it's been very interesting. Okay. I'd like to take just a minute and take a quick look at what I think are some important events in the industry that have happened, or in healthcare in general that have happened over the last about 100 years. So it helps me to visualize it if I draw something like a timeline. So I'll put something like the 1890s or the late 1800s at the beginning, and the present, 1988, here at the end. Okay. From 1890 to 1910, 1920, most healthcare services were delivered by two ways. Okay, they were delivered by physicians making house calls. Okay, probably I'm sure a lot of you remember that. I can't remember it ever happening in my lifetime, but I'm sure some of you have had that experience. That was one way, and the second way was hospitals. And hospitals were actually primarily charity institutions, okay? They were for people who didn't have money to afford healthcare, to a physician to come visit them. So they went to the hospitals. There actually wasn't a lot of care in the technological sense, like tests being run and drugs being administered. Going on in hospitals, it was primarily just nursing, okay? There was kind of helping people get over whatever was the matter with them. There were few rather primitive drugs and technologies available, but relatively little. So hospitals really served kind of a charity mission in the early years, and that's why we saw religious orders get involved in delivering health care a lot. In San Francisco, a lot of them have given up, but there's still a lot of remnants. There's like three or four different orders of Sisters of the Catholic Church that own hospitals. There is a Jewish hospital that was built for relatively poor Jewish residents of San Francisco. A variety of religious institutions were involved in delivering care that was charity-based. Well, going on up to, jumping on up to maybe about the 1930s or the 1940s, while this was still taking place, hospitals were getting a little bit more professional. More of the average patient like you and me, or even the well-to-do patient, was going into hospitals to get care delivered, because that's where technologies ended up being. Okay, like let's say the the one that jumps to my mind that fits this period is polio and the iron lung. Okay, has anyone seen an iron lung machine before or something like that? Okay, yeah, that was, I mean, not very portable, and you had to kind of go there to get that care delivered, okay? And so hospitals were starting to become more technologically based and more centralized, and healthcare was being more centralized. Well, I'm going to move through this real fast. In about 1960, in the 60s, there is a very big event in healthcare. Anyone have any idea what that is?
Medicare,
absolutely. Okay, Medicare and Medicaid. Is everyone familiar with what Medicaid is?
Yeah.
That's for indigent patients or for poor patients.
People who are on public assistance.
That's right, yeah.
On Medicaid.
Right, yeah. So Medicare and Medicaid. And what that did is infuse an incredible amount of money into healthcare. Because the government was starting to underwrite it. And there was also something else happening about this point in time, and I'm not going to write it down, I'll just tell you what it was. It was an act called the Hill-Burton Act that had to do with providing funds for hospitals to be built. I'm sorry?
To build them.
Yeah, that's right, to build hospitals in rural areas and in underserved areas. Okay. So there was a proliferation of hospitals being built in the late 50s and 60s and even into the 70s. In virtually any area, to the point where you go to a small town the size of Chelan and there's a hospital there, okay? Even though it was relatively small. The government underwrote that. So there is an incredible infusion of funds going on, and that infusion of funds ended up driving what you would probably expect, new technologies to be developed, a lot of new drugs to be developed, and so it's... Healthcare is getting to, at this point, to be a real big business, okay, to be a big deal, where before it wasn't really all that important, okay? in about the 1970s is where that profit thing starts to really kick in as an issue, because in the 1970s we start to see a lot of professional management being developed in the hospitals. In particular, the University of Minnesota has one of the most well-known hospital administration programs in the country. And so it's not surprising that area has been so well-developed in healthcare delivery because there's so many graduates coming out of that program. Okay, so the profit thing is starting to kick in the 1970s. Also, there's this phenomenon of for-profit hospitals, okay? Even national chains of hospitals. Like, has anyone heard of Humana or HCA or some of those? Yeah, and so this is an interesting issue for us to talk about, and I know we'll come back to it, especially later this evening, about should companies be making money on your misery, okay, or your illness? It's a good ethical question, probably, and one that hits right to the core of what I'm studying as a business student. And I'd say that the next major event occurred in about 1982, and I think it's the most revolutionary. And it's probably the one that you don't know about, or you might know about it. And that's that Medicare and Medi-Cal, which were now responsible for about 30-40% of expenditures on healthcare, total expenditures on healthcare by 1982, were put on something called diagnostic related groups, okay, or prospective reimbursement. Let me explain. When Medicare and Medi-Cal first started in the 60s and 70s, they reimbursed you, and they reimbursed your doctor, let's say if he or she handled the paperwork, on a cost plus basis. Okay, so you had your service, whatever it cost, the doctor tagged on their cost, their price, okay, plus a certain profit, charged the government, and they got paid for it, okay. Cost plus, 100%. Okay. What do you think that the effect of that would be for in terms of efficiency in costs? Sure. I mean, there's a great incentive.
They cheated.
They cheated, huh? Well, what's there a great incentive for them to do?
Profit. Overcharge.
Well, not overcharge. I mean, let's say that they're ethical to start with, okay? Which is a big if, okay? Absolutely. They've got a great incentive to test the living daylights out of you. I mean, you know, to run a dozen different tests. There's another good reason why they should want to run 100 different tests, and that's also going on here. Although
so they won't get sued.
That's right. That's right. Malpractice, okay? The rise. The lawyers have gotten into the game at this point and are starting to make it tough on the doctors, and so they've got good reasons to test, run every conceivable test on you so that when they get hauled to court, you know, let's say your case goes bad, they get hauled to court and say, well, I ran this test, okay? So the cost-plus world really supported that. In 1982, the world changed, okay, because the government made a conscious decision. They're looking at 10 years of healthcare costs. Inflation in 1982-83 was probably about, I'm guessing, overall inflation was probably about 6%, 5 or 6%. Healthcare inflation was about 15 or 16%, okay? Today, in 1988, overall inflation is only about 2%. Healthcare inflation is still in the double digits. It's about 11 or 12%, okay? The government is trying to get a hold of this incredible inflation in healthcare costs, and they've got good reason to, because they're bleeding in these Medicare and Medi-Cal programs, okay? They're really spending a lot of money. So they changed the rules, and the rules were when this individual comes into the hospital, you diagnose them, okay? And you say they've got an ulcerated colon or something like that, then we will reimburse you the average cost for all hospitals in your area for treating an ulcerated colon, or whatever it is, okay? And if your costs are less than that, then you make some money. If your costs are more than that, you lose money, okay? But we're going to pay you the average cost, okay? Well, the effect is probably obvious. Hospitals and physicians have been losing a lot of money because they were used to being able to tack on any charges they wanted to and charge essentially anything, run any test they wanted to. And now, if a person comes in with an ulcerated colon or whatever it is, and the physician says, well, I'd love to run these 10 tests, but the fact is, you know, we're only getting this much money, so I can only really afford to run a couple of tests, or four tests, or eight tests, okay? That has implications not only for cost, but also for the quality of your care, okay? Do they diagnose it correctly? Because maybe they missed an important test that they would have run before. Yes?
Not only that, if you go in for that type of a problem and come out with something else, you have the operation, you get infection, the hospital still only gets that amount of money besides the complications that may come up, which...
Very good point, and that's probably been one of the number one complaints of hospitals about the way the government has implemented DRGs and prospective reimbursement, is that they haven't taken into account complications. Well, there's a term in the insurance industry called adverse selection, and it happens when somebody comes in, maybe under an insurance policy, and they have a catastrophic illness, like spinal meningitis or something like that, and it just costs tons of money to treat this individual. Insurance companies lose money on that. Well, hospitals do, too. If someone comes in with a simple problem, gets DRG'd, and they get their reimbursement on that basis, and then complications develop, the hospitals can lose incredible amounts of money, okay? Where before they could just tack it on and the government would pay them back eventually. So that turns out to be a very important event, the advent of DRGs and prospective reimbursement. Any other questions or comments? Yes, please.
In regards to the cost, I guess last spring I had an experience. I was in the hospital for not quite 48 hours. And I got a bill for $900 from the hospital. And Medicare took care of it. Then a few weeks later, I got another bill for $3,000 for that particular case from the hospital. But when I called them and asked them about it, they said that that's what Medicare allowed them. So they bill of Medicare for it, and it was taken care of. So the hospital do get something back.
Yeah.
Many cases.
Yeah, well.
Mine was a short stay.
Well, and you're probably one that they made some money on. And when DRGs in 1982s and 1983 started, hospitals initially, they've kind of ratcheted down. Initially, they were still making money. But as the government has tightened the screws, it's gone down and down and down and down to the point where on most procedures, it's real difficult for them to make money unless they shuffle you out the door very fast, okay? And that's the number one performance measure of hospitals in 1988 is not, you know, net profit or other things that you would expect. It's length of stay. They try to lower the length of stay of their average patient, okay? And so that has implications for you, obviously, as far as, you know, are you really getting the care that you think you should get as a function of Medicare, or maybe an insurance plan that you've purchased? Yeah.
They said my mother-in-law said she was fine. I cried, did everything to try to get her to stay there, and she said, no, they said I can go home. Mm-hmm. And so then they hit her for another 4 weeks at their own expense.
Mm-hmm.
Came right back in about 3 hours later.
Yeah.
Never got out of there.
Yeah. Well, it's.
We did not sue.
Yeah. Good for you. It's. Lots of people have, and. Well, I'm particularly interested in these individuals who ride herd on these hospitals and try to keep track of this chaos that's going on around them, and they're fascinating individuals because a lot of them are not money grubbers, as you might expect.
So many hospitals are closing because they can't make it.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're not going to make it, people aren't going to get health care. I mean, there's got to be.
The government has made, I believe, a conscious decision to reduce the amount of hospital bed capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done that as a function of this and some other regulatory actions that they've taken, okay? There's incredible variations. Okay, rural hospitals, occupancy is like 20%. I mean, show me a hospital that can stay in business, or any business that can stay in business very long at that kind of thing. Okay.
But that's because they're forcing patients out.
Well, that's, and
really, that's why,
yeah, they're going to. It could be. But even in big cities, just a second, and I'll get to your question. Even in big cities, there's this incredibly strange thing going on because hospitals, like the average voluntary not-for-profit hospital in San Francisco's occupancy is 50%. Okay, they're losing big money. There isn't a hospital in San Francisco that's making it. But you go over to the county facility in Oakland, okay, and this is one of the toughest cities on the West Coast. Okay, yeah, and the county facility is stuffed to the gills. Okay, and the reason is that the county facility is the facility for indigent patients and patients that have nowhere else to go. And the other hospital, voluntary hospital, is a hospital for patients like you and I, more likely, okay? And we've got good incentive to leave early because the costs have gone through the roof. And we're not getting paid as much, or they're not paying as much because Medicare is paying less for us. So there's a variety of things leading into that occupancy problem, but it's they make money when they have patients in beds, right? Because they get upwards of $1,000 a day.
But a Medicaid patient in those county hospitals, they're losing money on. They can't.
Oh, absolutely.
Patients in there.
Yeah.
Because they're not enough beds for
them. Yeah, that's true. It's very true. It's very sad to see these big city hospitals and see how poorly served the average patient is. I mean, somebody comes in. San Francisco General is in our sample, a fascinating hospital. Patient comes in, they'll wait, I mean, they're very sick. They'll wait upwards of 2 or 3 hours to even get admitted.
They won't even let them in sometimes.
That's right, yeah, or they have to sit out in the waiting room.
The door.
Yeah.
No, they're not even taking them, they're turning them away.
I see.
They stand up by their team,
yeah.
Standing up a person that is so sick that it's...
Yeah, and then you go across town, and there's a hospital that's... Yeah, that doesn't have enough business. It's almost nonsensical. You had a comment.
Well, yes, you're actually saying Medicaid and Medicare are you know, decreasing the length of stays, et cetera, your insurance companies, your private insurance companies are dictating where people are being sent home after major surgery in one day. They're not ordering the adequate laboratory tests ahead of time to determine if there's any complications that could be setting in.
Yeah.
They're going to be bringing patients into surgery that shouldn't be brought in for one reason or the other, or be treated prior.
Yeah.
So I think we should also say insurance companies when we're saying who's limiting the cost.
Well, absolutely, and I didn't mean to leave that out, and the discussion's been good, so I've been kind of hesitant to move on to the other things that I've had to talk about, but one of those is the advent of this notion of managed care, okay? Maybe you've heard that, but you've definitely heard of an HMO before, right?
Yes.
A health maintenance organization. That's the whole idea, okay? That's a different way to try to get a hold of this healthcare inflation that's going on. Your insurance companies have an incentive to do that too, because the costs have eaten up their profits, and if hospitals have just recently come to the profit game, insurance companies have always been in the profit game, and they're going to guarantee their returns, and they'll do that by lowering what they'll pay and raising the premium, which both of which have happened. Okay. Yes.
Do you know anything about the national health care in Canada or England or anywhere?
You know, I'm not very well. Maybe somebody else does. I'm not too well prepared to talk about that.
Do you think our government will?
Well, it's certainly that was in fact one of the implications that I wanted to talk about is maybe. I mean, Senator Kennedy, like him or not, suggests that maybe that's one way in which we should look. Before we get into that, maybe I can spend a few minutes going on if there was like one.
When
or two
I did a research on the British Columbia Medical, this was of some 10-15 years ago, but at that time they were spending 2/3, that is, of cost their country. About 2/3 what we were on medical things, and they were educating their doctors and providing everything for, at that time, it was $10 insurance per person.
Yeah.
And we got very, very good care of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that sounds like a success story. I know that in Europe, there have been some experiences that were not nearly as good with nationalized health care.
Well, there are also other Canadian provinces that aren't as good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But British Columbia has been very. The other success story of it is that doctors who hated it to begin with or were afraid of it, their sons are going into it and they love it.
Uh-huh.
Why they have time at home, they don't have to work all the time.
Yeah.
Unless they want to.
Yeah.
If they want to, they can go out and take private patients.
Yeah.
So they can make whatever they want if they're hoggish, but most of them get adequate payment and they decide they like not working 24 and 40 hours.
Uh-huh. Well, let me just move on a little bit and introduce a couple other issues, and then we'll let the discussion. I hate to put any brakes on discussion at all, but in trying to sum up the changes that have driven this revolution, at least what I think is a revolution, okay, I'd come up with three. The first is the one that I've talked about as most obvious, which is regulatory changes, okay, have had a very big effect. The second we haven't talked about too much, and I'd like to for a minute if we can, and that's technology and how technology has played a role in how healthcare has changed. You folks in here have lots of perspective on this because you've seen healthcare from the time you were children until now, and that's almost the period of my study. I mean, that's a long time, and you've seen some big changes. Okay, and technology is one of the most potent forces, I believe, in what's going on in healthcare because it's changing so rapidly. A few years ago, it wasn't that long ago, the CAT scanner was one of the big things. Has anyone had a CAT scan in here? Okay. Lots of you have, and that's not too surprising. That's a technology that has diffused a lot. It's a very expensive technology, it was at first. And it's gotten cheaper as time has gone on, but it's already been replaced by a new and better technology. Does anyone know what that is?
MRI.
Yeah, it's a great audience. It's called a magnetic resonance imaging machine, or MRI, okay? The CAT scanner was maybe as big, the first CAT scanner was maybe as big as half this room. The MRI scanner's first one took a whole floor of a hospital, and these incredibly big magnets. Now they've gotten much better, to the fact where they're even portable now.
But it allows doctors to see even further into your brain and your body as a result of magnetic imaging as opposed to the CAT scan method. And I won't even begin to talk about the technologies because I can't. But anyway, it's a radically new diagnostic technology. Let me use the MRI as an example. Very, very expensive. And also, it's not that commonly used. I mean, a doctor would only request an MRI test under certain circumstances. So hospitals have had to band together to buy MRIs, which is an interesting result, because they've got to offset the cost of this MRI. They got to have it. They don't want to lose business to the hospital down the street if they don't have an MRI, okay? But they've linked together with other hospitals to get it, okay? Well, it's a very costly procedure, and the relevance for our discussion is, I believe, at what point does technology become maybe too much, okay, in healthcare delivery? This definitely is relevant to discussions on euthanasia, keeping, and at what cost, okay? People have generally had the attitude in the United States, I believe, that we deserve the best in healthcare. It's one of those things that will forget the cost. I want the best. I mean, I want to stay alive. But when you start talking about especially indigent patients and in the incredible costs that are going up in keeping people alive, I believe it's a relevant point at some point to say, where should we draw a line and say we can't go any further, or we've got to kind of ration some of this technology a little bit, because not everyone can have MRIs.
Who's going to make that decision?
I can't answer that. I'm just merely posing the question.
I understand. Yes. In England they're doing that.
Is that right?
Yeah, my family knows they're doing that. They started doing it. Now, how they do it, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So they are doing it.
Yes.
I was going to say, I think the big hospitals have a team of ethics right now that kind of decide.
It'd be a team of physicians.
Yeah, a team that decides what's going to happen.
Is that right?
Well, I know ministers in Seattle, it's been going on for years, and ministers sit in on it.
Uh-huh. I see.
But really, the legal responsibility there for those things lies with the patient or their spokesperson. And, you know, there's ministers or hospital people, they have no right whatsoever to.
Oh, yes, they do, because we're all paying for the insurance. And we can't let this insurance and the payments just keep going on forever. So it's become an ethical question on where are we going to put the line.
Yeah.
Okay.
Having some problems hearing. So everyone who does make some comments, if you would please speak up. I saw some other hands. I thought. Okay. Well, I just hang on to that. I know that's kind of rolling around in your mind. Probably we'll come back to it because I think that's an intriguing issue. The third big change that I think has taken place over here. Actually, it's not a change so much as it's a series of changes. Are very big social political changes, okay? Social first, all right? The baby boom generation is getting older, okay? And I'm kind of a tailor on that generation, but they're going to be demanding more healthcare services. The system is already in disarray, okay? It's already hemorrhaging. What's gonna happen, all right, with that? The expectation, and I hinted at this before, that everyone is entitled to the very best health care. Can we hang on to that, given this big bulge of people that are going to be getting older, the costs of new technology, and government policies, political decisions, to put the screws on health care expenses, okay? We'll get into the politics of it, but the Reagan administration has made a conscious decision to de-emphasize social programs, and one of those has been healthcare. Okay, and so there's been some effects of that. So those kind of changes are going on as well. From my perspective as a researcher, it's a fascinating industry to study, and fascinating, and it's relevant because it affects everybody, and I hope we can make some good sense of some of the things that we see going on. What have been some of the effects? We've talked about some of them.
Healthcare is now a big business. Okay, we talked a little bit about profit making. It's fragmented a lot. Originally doctors, okay, in the 1800s, early on the timeline. Then hospitals, primary deliverers of care. Now, you can get down the street, right, to they call them doc in the boxes, okay, the 24-hour emergency center, okay, get stitched up or, you know, get some drugs or whatever you need, okay. Some of you have probably gone for services in what they call freestanding centers, like a freestanding imaging center. You've gone maybe for a CAT scan or some an X-ray in a center that's not in the hospital. Okay, maybe you've gone to get some surgery in a short stay facility that's not in the hospital. Okay, has anyone done that?
Day
surgery. Okay. That's going on. There are some people making big money off of that. Doctors are amongst them, but also entrepreneurs. That's an issue, I think, and been an effect of some of these changes, is there's been this fragmentation, but there's also been some profit-making going on. Okay. Another effect is healthcare cost inflation has not come down. One could argue that the government's policies have been a miserable failure, because healthcare cost inflation is still running about 12%, and that's 10% over the inflation rate. Yes.
I think part of the reason they've been such a failure is at the same time they try and cut costs by the DRGs,
mm-hmm.
and they're putting new rules into Medicare that are so crazy that it just makes no sense. We had a patient the other day. He came in, we looked at him, he had earwax. We fixed the earwax problem by washing it out. They would only reimburse him $16. Because we had taken care of the problem that day. If you would have came back the next day, they would have reimbursed the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're kind of killing themselves, too.
Yeah, oh, I should tell you about what some of the stories that these hospital administrators have told us in our interviews, because it's fascinating. They have what they call readmits. And what they'll do now to get around DRG restrictions is they'll get a person in, they'll do the initial diagnosis, they'll treat them, then a complication results. They will actually physically shove them out the door and bring them back in and readmit them so that they can get a new DRG for that. I mean, it's silly, but it's happening, okay? And much more ridiculous things than that, okay?
But that's because of the Medicare rules.
Well, I don't know. Would anyone care to answer that? Is there anything the matter? Yeah, well, she said, what's the matter with 12% inflation? I mean, is there anything inherently wrong about that?
Well, it's too much. Too much.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to take the words out of
you. Well, it's not great, but what I'm saying is, it's a lot worse in the past.
Okay.
It could be even worse.
So, well, what she's suggesting is that it's improved, and it could be a lot worse. I don't know. Yes.
What's the matter with it is that all the other inflation is 2%.
It's if you let me put it this way. Okay. Let's say that you're one of the very few patients out there that's still actually paying for part of your medical services, as I do, okay. If your wages are only going up 2%, okay, let's say they're keeping pace with inflation, and healthcare inflation is 12%, your real earning power and real spending power in terms of healthcare services is going down, obviously, okay. You're right, there's been some improvement. I think the government would like to see a lot more improvement than that. And my guess is they'll tighten the screws even harder, okay, to get it. Some other effects, okay, and one of the most interesting and the most tragic has been the deterioration of care for the underserved segments of the population. We talked about that a little bit with county hospitals, okay. It's incredible. One of our best interviews was with a woman who was the administrator of Highland General, which is the hospital in Oakland. They get like 10 knife and gun or gunshot wounds daily, lots of trauma, okay, as a result of gang violence. They also are like the number one place for AIDS as a result of IV drug use, intravenous drug use, okay. Primarily, all this happens amongst individuals without health care insurance that are not even eligible for Medi-Cal, okay, or Medicaid, it's called Medi-Cal in California. And so they fall into this indigent class, okay, and the state pays for that. Well, the state has cut back their money tremendously, as they have in most states, okay? As a result, the hospitals are overwhelmed. They don't have enough money. They're running 20 to 30% below what they should be on nurses. Are you a nurse?
Medical assistant.
I mean, it's in fact, it was in, I picked up a copy of the Washington Post Weekly over here in the reading room last week, and there was a front page story. It was about this hospital, which was really fascinating. So,
but every individual hospital insists on getting these machines.
Well, that and that's a very
that's
a very relevant point for technology. I mean, should we when I said should we be rationing that, I not only meant should we ration it for patients, should we also ration it for hospitals? Does every hospital have to have an MRI scan?
No, they don't.
Yeah.
Not every hospital has.
Yeah. Well, when you instill the profit motive in some of them, they have an incentive to have one,
right,
because they want to keep you as a patient. They don't want to lose you to their competitor down the street. But the fact is, you know, I mean, you can say they shouldn't, and they may not right now, but my guess is they will in a couple of years, or most of them will, okay? That's because they have to stay in business. Yes?
Well, in Seattle and in most of the cities, the hospitals have now had to form a group,
yeah,
and they've had to decide that the University of Washington Hospital will be heart,
yeah,
and that the Hutchinson Cancer Center will,
yeah,
be cancer,
yeah,
and that the, you know, the Harborview County,
mm-hmm,
will be the trauma,
yeah,
and
Swedish.
And Swedish is what? And anyway, you see,
probably
these
will be cancer,
trauma, that's heart.
Yeah.
See, and so you can only go because you can't afford,
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, well, and that's a good point. Hospitals are finally coming to grips with this, and they're doing it by forming these networks, and that's a particular interest of mine. But also, there's something called patient dumping going on. Does anybody know what that is? Sounds attractive, doesn't it? Well, it's see the let's say a patient comes in with a gunshot wound to the average district hospital or something like that. They're an indigent patient. The district hospital knows they're going to lose money on this patient, okay? So all they are required by the state to do is stabilize them and then ship them off to the county facility, which is supposed to provide for indigent patients. Well, there's been a strong incentive, and it has happened, for these hospitals to just refuse admittance at all and to push these, dump these patients on county hospitals, and which are already overwhelmed, okay? So there's been a number of court cases amongst hospitals, even in our sample in California, dumping patients. Okay, and that has to be an important effect, I believe. Yes.
But if the state or the government is only going to pay 40% of the cost, and that's what they pay for welfare patients, they're never going to. You know, they've got to pay. You know, a more equitable.
Yeah.
Amount, you know, for other hospitals,
yeah,
to take.
But
you can't pay 40% of their cost and expect, you know.
Yeah. Well, and you're absolutely right.
You know.
But what kind of position is the state in? I mean, show me a state government that isn't in a budget deficit. There's few of them. Okay.
But then our priorities perhaps have to change.
Okay. Okay. Perhaps. Yes.
I do think a lot of patients that think they're being dumped are not being dumped. They are being sent to the heart hospital,
mm-hmm,
because the hospital that they happen to go to can't handle them. Or, you know, or,
yeah,
they're going to the trauma hospital.
Yeah.
They're not actually being dumped by the patient.
Yeah.
The hospital is a lot of families feel.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up a very interesting issue, which is that maybe 20 years ago, when you went to a hospital, you probably went to the nearest one, okay, the hospital in your neighborhood or your community, okay. And each hospital was kind of required to provide a wide range of services. Now they're specializing, as you suggested, moving in. One hospital will have a specialty in heart, and one will in oncology, and one will in trauma. Usually the inner city hospitals have a trauma specialty, not surprisingly, because there's a lot of trauma business.
And add to that, on top of that, insurance is where your insurance will let you go, on top of which hospital you can,
yeah,
go to.
Well, and if you're in an HMO or a, mm-hmm, what's called a preferred provider organization, a PPO plan, they will tell you which doctors you can go to as well as which hospitals, right? And in California, the major force is Kaiser. Has anyone heard of Kaiser before?
Yeah,
yeah, the nation's oldest and largest HMO. And and they're very successful. They have their own whole string of hospitals. HMOs? Yeah, a lot of HMOs are going bankrupt. You're quite right. Yeah, Kaiser is one of the few that's being successful. Yes.
I think the ambulances have to have a triage system so that all the calls go into one central switchboard, and then they decide, we'll take this guy with the gunshot wound to the university and this lady to maternity.
Yeah.
And avoid this stuff that
talking. And I don't know about Seattle. Seattle's always been one of those markets that's kind of ahead in emergency care, I believe. But in San Francisco, this is just being developed. I mean, you would think they would have this developed long ago, but it's just starting to kick in down there. So, a couple other effects. We're probably running a little short on time.
10 minutes?
Okay. I think we'll have lots of time for discussion later after Vespers, and I hope you all come. We talked a little bit about the fragmentation of services. Somebody mentioned, and we kind of skipped over it, hospital closures. In the San Francisco area, over a period of 10 to 15 years, there's been about 10% of hospitals have closed. In rural areas, it's much higher, because they're the ones that have really lost money. Small county governments can't afford to keep them open. So that has some effects for persons. Actually, if you live in a big city, your healthcare services are much better served than if you live in a rural area, where oftentimes it can be very difficult to get services. Some of you probably have some experience with that. So that's an issue, okay. One interesting one is the decline of indemnity insurance or cost plus insurance. Most of you probably had 10 years ago a plan where they paid you had a certain deductible, and then there was an 80% major medical or something like that, a basic benefit. How many of you are now in an HMO PPO type of plan? Yeah, that's actually probably a little bit less than the average. I'd say 50% of Americans are now in some type of managed care plan. Well, that's had implications for the insurance companies, because they make a lot less money on that plan, that kind of plan, and so do the hospitals, than they do on a full indemnity cost plus plan. But it's you've got good reasons for joining those types of things oftentimes, because it's a lot cheaper. And their premiums for traditional indemnity plans have gone through the roof in most places. Some implications feeding into the forum tonight. Can we afford to get sick? Okay, maybe not. I'm kind of wondering by the time I'm 30 or 40 years older if I'll be able to afford to get sick. The average patient that is reaching hospitals now is a lot sicker than the average patient was 10 years ago. People are making conscious decisions not to get care. Let me use an example. When was the last time you went to have a routine physical examination done? Anyone?
We have one
every year. Do you? Wow. Well, I guess I asked the wrong question. You folks are probably very conscientious. I would say the average person doesn't get it done very much anymore.
We're older than you.
Yeah. And HMO plans kind of discourage it sometimes. Okay. Oh, is that right? Well, they differ. Okay. I guess I can't make that generalization. But I know I was in an HMO where the guy said, you don't really need to come for a routine physical. Okay. Maybe I'm biased. Okay. Well, it is generally believed that preventative and pre-diagnostic methods are being used less now, and there's fewer of those services delivered because they're costly, and so the average patient does end up being a lot sicker, it seems. There's also an impersonalization of care going on, I believe, and I think most of you probably had some experience with that. Definitely different from the early 1900s when you had your family physician, or even maybe you did, 20 or 30 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. maybe you still do, I don't know. To now when I've always felt treated like cattle, you know, whenever I had to go for most health care services. And some HMOs are trying to use that to their advantage and get you, put you with a particular doctor so you get, you know, this feeling that you're getting personalized care. But overall, it's been a problem. Now, we talked about questioning this cherished notion that Americans are entitled to the best of care regardless of the cost. That may be something that we need to question, given the changes in this revolution that's going on here. And the final thing, I guess, the final implication, and we discussed a little bit, was should businesses be allowed to make profits on your ill fortune? And that plays into the issue of nationalized care. That's the extent of the comments I had prepared for you. Just open it up for discussion. Yes.
Well, not only hospitals but they're going into business. They're having motels, they're having and the sad part about it is a lot of these hospitals are trying to get all of this tax-free.
That's right.
Even though it's not necessarily treatment that they're getting, but they're, mm-hmm. all their land.
Yeah, they have tax-free status, most of them, because they're voluntary, not-for-profit organizations. It's really intriguing. One of the hospitals in our sample, a small 55-bed facility in a relatively small bedroom community of San Francisco Bay Area, they hired the Stanford MBA, and this guy decided he was going to turn this into a little business. And he took like a $4 million endowment that the hospital had, and they had a very passive hospital board, and he invested in a sand and gravel company and a yogurt company and something else, lost an incredible amount of money, got fired, got a severance contract for about $300,000 when he left, what they call a golden parachute, maybe some of you have heard about that, and is a subject of a grand jury investigation. This is all a sleepy little bedroom community hospital in San Francisco, and so that's an intriguing example of some of those changes.
We've got about 4 minutes. I just wanted to clarify tonight the ethics meeting forum. Is it going to be in this room or in the next room?
I believe it's in the fireside room, okay. But I'm not.
Well, when you leave, I'd like to have you leave your chairs where they are, and we'll arrange it.
Okay.
About 2 minute countdown right now.
2 minute countdown?
No problem.
All right. Yes?
Of course, I always think a greater emphasis should be on prevention from early days.
How do we create an incentive for that? What kind of changes do we make to the system to instill more prevention and less cure?
More knowledge
amongst us as patients.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there is a lot more knowledge now amongst us as patients than there was 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, along with that knowledge has to go. I mean, I work and I have an insurance plan, but the insurance plan available through my school district does not pay for preventive medicine.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's like even if I think it's important, you tend not to go for it.
Sure.
Because your insurance doesn't pay that.
Yeah.
Some of the hospitals have seniors.
Some of the hospitals are putting forth preventive
Medicare symposiums and all sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, yes. Well, let's have like one or two more questions, and we'll save the rest for the forum. Yes.
Well, and we're all learning now that nutrition is most of it, and the doctors are. Nutrition course in their whole medical field. The nurses do. So we're learning, we need to know, nutrition. We're learning much more about how we have to go out and be aerobic.
Yeah.
And we're learning that the rest of it is caused by our mind and thinking. And we also need to acknowledge that the smokers are bringing up most of the medical costs, and yet we're paying the same on the insurance. So we're sure going to have to change that.
That's changing. That's aren't there no smokers policies now? I believe there are. Well, that's a whole different issue. Let's draw it to a close. But thank you very much for coming.